This is the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best tips and strategies in the world to help you become a smarter, more effective tennis player. You'll hear interviews with Pro Tour doubles players and coaches, including easy-to-use lessons to improve your game and win more matches. My name is Will Bocek, founder of the Tennis Tribe, doubles strategy coach, and host of the show. In this episode, I talk with Joel Drucker. Joel has been in the tennis industry for longer than I've been alive. He has covered tennis for over 30 years and has had his work featured in HBO, CBS, The Tennis Channel, The New York Times, Huffington Post, Forbes, The LA Times, and many, many more places around the country. Joel and I, in this episode, we talk a lot about doubles. So the reason I reached out to him was that he wrote a piece recently for tennis.com about how ATP doubles players can transition in this post-Bryan Brothers era that we're moving towards. So as I'm sure you know, the Bryan Brothers recently decided to retire, and Joel's article has five really great ideas on how pro doubles players can grow the game of doubles without the Bryan Brothers kind of helping support it like they've done over the last 10 to 20 years. So Joel and I talk about all five of his ideas. We talk about the evolution of the game of doubles, including how doubles strategy has changed over the years, as well as how singles players used to play doubles all the time, then they quit, and now they're kind of starting to again. We also talk about a lot of stories that Joel has. Like I said, he's been in the industry a long time, and he has a really great story of a match he played with John McEnroe and Jimmy Connors for an exhibition match. He has a story of being flown to a clinic with the Jensen brothers in the late 90s. He has some good stories with the Bryan brothers. We talk about a specific drill that he learned from the Bryan brothers as well. And then at the end, I ask him about some of the pieces he's written over the years, which I'll link to in the show notes as well. So this was a really fun conversation with a lot of great stories from somebody who knows tennis probably better than anybody at this point. So without further ado, I do hope you enjoy this conversation with Joel Drucker. All right, and we're live. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today we have Joel Drucker on. Joel is a writer for tennis.com and has been in the industry for a long time at this point. Joel, how are you?
I'm all right. Well, how are you?
I'm doing well. So the reason I reached out to you is that you recently wrote a doubles letter on tennis.com, and you called it a letter to ATP doubles players or something like that. And it was all about how doubles can kind of survive in this post-Bryan Brothers era. Can you start out with just kind of how that piece came to be? And
sure. And let me paint a picture. Let me draw a picture. And this is a little bit of how I see contemporary doubles. Imagine you're watching 10 great basketball players on a basketball court. And they're great. And they're leaping, and they're jumping, and they're shooting, and they're rebounding. They're showing a lot of the skills that make the game great. And none of them have uniforms. They're wearing random uniforms, gray shirts, brown shirts, different shirts. None of them have their names on their shirt. None of them have numbers. None of them have team logos on them. But boy, they're pretty good at basketball. Yeah. And that, to me, is almost the picture of how I see ATP doubles, particularly in the post-Bob Mike era. Bob Mike, they were the marquee guys for a good 15 years, and they kind of really, they sold it. They drew us into doubles. The other guys, they're all great, and they're hard to distinguish from one another. Right. So that makes our ability to connect with them and follow them and want to see them less than great. I mean, it's like, okay, I'm going to walk past the sports zone, and I'm going to see 10 guys playing great basketball, but I'm not going to know who any of them are.
Right. And then so, the next day you'll see them playing with a completely different person too.
Well, there'll be different teammates. It won't even matter. Yeah. It won't even matter because they're just playing, but none of it matters. There's no sense of any connection to any of them. I mean, that's not entirely fair. People follow different ones at different times, different players. I think I think over the years, I think they were obviously the Bryan brothers, and Daniel Nestor had a certain longevity aspect, particularly because he's such a great doubles player and big lefty, and Leander Paes has brought a lot of attention, excitement to doubles, and all of these guys, they're all very good. Jamie Murray has an interesting affinity because of his accomplishments and also that he's part of an incredible tennis family. But again, in the big picture, if you brought out glossy pictures of me of the top 10 doubles players right now and said, I'd see that guy, I'd go, And I think you might also. And we followed.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't. Yeah.
We do this for our jobs. So right. Think of the fan. So how does the fan get involved with it? So that kind of, I wish, as I shared that picture with you just now, I wish I'd put that picture in the article, that concept. So I'm articulating it now. And that really kind of sets the tone and my mess for these doubles players.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of the idea behind, you know, my blog and me starting this podcast was to help grow the game of doubles, because it doesn't make any intuitive sense to me, because most of the fans, you go to the US Open, obviously not this year, but most years you see, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and the vast majority of them are on the doubles court. They're not on the singles court, right?
Recreationally, people would play. Almost
every single one of them is going to watch Serena play singles and Federer play singles. And doubles doesn't have to be bigger than singles. I mean, I think we'd be really far away from that, but why isn't it bigger than it is?
And well, I guess your question is, so why do people who mostly play doubles go to watch singles?
That's part of it. I think
I'll have an answer for you. You know, I sing in the shower, but I don't go to a concert to watch someone else sing in the shower. So I think what people want to see when they watch tennis and when they have their spectator mindset on, sure, is I want to watch it played as well as it can be played. And so doubles, they play it and they enjoy watching it. I mean, we know, you and I have probably sat in enough pro doubles matches that when people are sitting there watching it, they're enjoying it. It's just that they're following it, their attention to it is far less. The great thing about tennis, and this is almost more important for the doubles guys to understand, tennis, you follow people more than even teams. You right. follow Serena and Roger, and they're even recognizable to people who don't even know tennis, who barely know a forehand from a backhand, because they're individuals. So they're singular franchises, whereas the doubles people are just kind of, again, they're invisible. So right. I appreciate their skills, but there's nothing that grips us to them. And they're not, and then it gets the whole thing like they don't promote themselves.
Yeah, we need kind of a story to grab onto. And I want to go through, so you had five pieces in that article, pieces of advice for the doubles players. And I want to go through those. And I think really by the end of this conversation, I want the ATP and WTA reaching out to us and saying, we need you all to help us fix this. I want us to fix it.
I think if we can create a show, that's funny you mentioned that. I wanted to bring my article to the attention of some of my, some people I know at the ATP. So, okay. So we want to, let's see if we can get an audience. Let's see if we can get an audience and have someone at least listen to us and hope and have, and some of that. So, all right. So why don't you talk through each one of them?
Okay. So let's fix it on this call. So number one is names on their shirts. So talk us through that.
Very simple. Let me know who you are. I mean, I walk around a tournament. I want to know who that guy's name is. I think the singles guy should do that too. Mm-hmm. But the doubles guys, all the more reason to.
Right.
And have the names and let me know who you are all over the tournament. So see them walking around, see them at practice, see them coming back from practice. Let me know who you are. I'm going to ask for your autograph. And then you can know why should they be invisible? And of course, on the court when they're playing, I mean, they do it in the team sports. They do it in the big time sports. Why not in tennis?
Yeah. That's yeah. Cool. I love that idea. The thing that came to mind when I was reading that was when I was younger, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and I used to go to the Grizzlies games when I was younger, and I didn't always know the away team, but you'd show up, you'd walk in the stadium, you'd sit in your seat, and there'd be a little kind of game guide, and it would have every player listed, the country they're from, how many years they're in the league, and their number. So you can watch and be like, oh, who just made that three? Look in your guide and you can see the name of them, where they're from, stuff like that. And I guess tennis may not be able to do that since the matches are kind of turning over in the stadium so fast, but they've got the apps now to be able to do that.
What, to put the name on the shirt?
No, I mean to have like a kind of a game guide or
Like a game guide?
Information about the players.
Those are apps. All these tournaments have apps that detail the tournament. So people sit in their seats looking at the app to see, oh, John Jones doubles. And they can scroll that. That's
right.
And they, oh, he's from Memphis. He's from London.
Yeah.
He's 24.
Yeah, a short little bio. Stuff
his
like
father
that.
Played rugby.
Right.
Whatever. Right. That's stuff that gets you connected to them. Absolutely.
Yeah. Is it so with these apps, most of the tournaments kind of have their own app, correct?
A lot of tournaments have their own app, but you can also at any tournament, you can also go to the ATP or WTA.
Okay.
And that, yeah. They either have apps or they, even if they don't have apps, you can search them while you're watching.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing that I feel like is the more I'm kind of learning about the industry is that a lot of it's kind of disconnected. So like Wimbledon might have their own app. Australian Open might have their own app. Whereas it'd be easier if we just had like an ATP app, right?
The ATP does have an app, I think, for the ATP, but for each tournament, it's complicated. The game isn't organized the way the major professional North American sports are. It's not quite organized that way, for better or worse.
Okay, so names on shirts. I think we're convinced that that's a good idea.
I'm convinced they're all good ideas. That's why I wrote them.
The second one is, well, hopefully the listeners are convinced at this point. The second one is reach out to tournament directors, become an ambassador.
So you realize that the doubles life, okay, what do they play at a tournament? They play two no-ed sets and a tiebreaker. That's less tennis than I play in some of my 4 or 5 league matches. I don't play no-ed. So they're on the court, the longest length of a doubles match that way, 2 hours at the most. It's 2 hours. Let me figure out you get another. Okay, let's give you, for the heck of it, let's give you another 2 hours of practice. That's 4 hours in a day. And let's give you another hour of downtime for trainer stuff. You had 5 hours of that, and that's fine. That's good. That's hard work. I get it. So maybe the rest of the time, these guys should be leading the league in clinics. They should be doing autograph sessions. They should be doing sponsor visits. They should do all sorts of things that make themselves accessible to the tournaments. There are not as many demands on their time as there are for Roger Federer. So I think they've had a great opportunity to be this ambassador for all these events in different kind of ways. And and then that can maybe move the needle, and then you can have people want to watch them play.
Yeah, so you mentioned pro-am, charity, autograph sessions. So I'm envisioning kind of like a tent set up somewhere in the outside the stadiums, and you know, they have a big sign up that says, you know, doubles autograph session at 3 o'clock or something like that.
Something like, look, that's how this gets executed is kind of fun. It depends how the tournament configures it and what they have and what their charity event is, if they want to do them, or what their community thing is, or what they want to do with kids coming from school, or what their clinic is. I mean, that's all in the hands of each event and the attitude of the doubles people to really do it, to keep following through on it.
Right. And it'll be the doubles players first reaching out to the...
Well, why wouldn't they? I mean, the doubles people... Yeah. We'll touch on some other examples of this. I'll give you some examples. Why wouldn't they? I mean, they want to... It's funny. I talked once with an ATP leader once, and he said, they shouldn't use the term giving back. It's called taking from. If I run an auto company, if I'm the CEO of Pontiac and I go to the dealership to talk, I'm not giving back. I'm growing the game. I'm getting people to know me. The musician who goes to a record store, is he giving back? No, he's selling records.
Right. Yeah. It makes tons of sense. So that goes into the next one. Access is everything. Your third point.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting in tennis. In some of the sports, such as the team sports, journalists are allowed in the clubhouse up till 45 minutes before the game. And they can talk with the players, or at least attempt to talk to the players. In tennis, it's pretty much you're never going to get an interview with a player before they play, even if they're playing at 10 at night. And again, I think the doubles players should go to much greater lengths to make themselves accessible, to make it easier to get time with them, to do interviews, and not just do, a perfunctory 15 minutes. The Jensens, Luke and Murphy, I was doing a story on them, and in the middle of a tournament, they were doing a clinic that involved taking a helicopter and, you know, going in a car to this event. And I spent a whole day with them, and I was in the helicopter, and we went out in the car, and they were in the clinic. And then part of their clinic, me and another guy got to play a tiebreaker versus with them as part of the clinic. It's a whole participatory experience. And I did, and that was 25 years ago, and I will talk about that story till I die. The same with the Bryan brothers. I'm writing a story about them and their dad, and the dad said, oh, come watch the practice. And in the middle of the practice, Bob said, hey, grab a racket. We need someone kind of at the net, you know, just like as a stick figure. Just do that for a few minutes. And again, that just gave me a better sense of how they do what they do. Not every story has to be like that. Not every story has to be this first prison experience, but gee, that type of involvement, that type of connection. Now you know more. Bob, Mike, Luke, Murphy. Get to know who these guys are.
Yeah, those are great stories. I was actually just about to ask about those. So where was this this clinic that Luke and Murphy took you to?
Luke and Murphy Jensen were playing a tournament in San Jose, California. That's about an hour south of San Francisco. That used to be this tournament called Various Incarnations, most recently the SAP Open, the Sybase Open, a long-standing tournament. And the event is at an indoor place, and they had arranged to do a clinic in Marin County. That's about an hour from where they were, a little north of San Francisco. So they had this clinic. I forget it was a Tuesday afternoon, Wednesday. And we met at the tennis event in San Jose, and I drove with them, and we went to the helicopter, and I flew with them in the helicopter and learning who they are, and also learning who they are in motion, in a helicopter on the way. I mean, think of what a great story that is, how that lays out the picture of who they are, and talking about their lives and what they loved about tennis, and then going with them to this little charity event at a club. I forget if it was a charity or community event, and there are people around there. And then I got to be on the court with them, which was really fun. I mean, I've had a lot of those experiences, which we can talk about later. So got to play with them and feel the ball and feel what it's like to be on the court with world-class players. So that was pretty fun too.
So were they, number four is please teach. So were they teaching a clinic on the court for like?
This was more of a exhibition. I mean, they did a couple of things with me, and then they did something with some local, some better players and some college players. This wasn't a clinic. This is more of a mini exhibition, I believe. I don't recall there being a clinic. There might have been, but I can't recall that.
Okay. So let's dive into number four then. You said, please teach.
Sure. Why don't the doubles players put out content on the ATP and WTA, each of their respective genders, that teaches about doubles? Show highlights from a match and then break that down, explain to us what that is and why that works and what doesn't work. And then maybe talk about a drill that you can do to practice it. So, okay, they're going to show us, you and I are going to be playing doubles together. And here's the eye formation with the poach. And why do you do that? I mean, they do these things at warp speed. I mean, they run these plays, these pros at speeds that are just unbelievable. Nonetheless, I think a lot of reason people enjoy watching doubles is think, how can I do that? Now, some things you can do and some things you can't do, but at least learning how to do those things, or learning how to return serve and volley and teach us some things or give examples. It's always interesting when I talk with great doubles players and they talk about communicating. And I always want to say, yeah, I get it. Could you think a little harder? Could you give me three examples of where that came in play in a vivid way? Tell me about the time in Tokyo and you're down a set in 3-1. And what communicating meant at that point. What did you guys actually talk about? What did you say? Or what did you say when you were trying to close out an upset win? I mean, I just think there's a much greater level of detail that we can get into with all these players.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it kind of goes back to most of the fans play doubles. So can you give them some insights, some tips, some strategies, some ways to communicate with your partner that maybe they're not already doing?
Well, I think a lot of people, when they watch doubles on television, they enjoy watching it to learn, to see how they might play better. Now, and they know it's different than when they watch singles. You can watch singles for that. But singles are also watching for just sheer entertainment and appreciation of excellence. But doubles, I don't think, and this has to do with how the doubles tour is set up, I don't think they're watching it to pay attention to the point standings. I don't think they're thinking about who's going to be eight and who's going to be four and who's in the race to London. I don't think they think about that, fans.
Yeah, I know that's why – that's a lot of the reason I watch it is to try to learn from my own game.
Yeah, do you watch it to see who's going to be number three in the point race?
No, I don't even keep up with it.
And there you go. And you have a business organized around doubles.
Yeah, I definitely watch more for the strategies and definitely the entertainment value as well. But, yeah, I don't keep up with the rankings a whole lot or things like that. So number five is hire a promotional leadership team.
Right. It's not about just operating doubles and making it function. It's about getting people excited, and you need someone who knows how to do that. I cited two of my favorites were Wayne Bryan, Luke Jensen, but there might be others. People who can really get people excited about doubles, about what it can mean and what it can do, and look for ideas and look to promote it, look to do things. I mean, you mentioned Memphis and your Grizzlies experience. So one of my childhood heroes, having grown up in LA, was Jerry West, who did a great job in Memphis, and he's the NBA logo. He's the logo for the NBA, and let's create a doubles logo. All the things that constitute promotional strategies that we've seen the other sports do. All-time doubles teams of all time. Matt, do some fun talk about, ask some of the great doubles players which doubles player from the past they'd want to play with and why, and then let's explore what that might look like. What would it look like if Kulhoff played with John McEnroe or sure. Something like that?
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah, I talked with so it sounds like they need a kind of their own committee and then somebody to go out and kind of execute a lot of the strategies and the ideas that they come up with as far as promoting doubles, creating a logo, things like that. I talked with Gabby Dabrowski earlier this summer, who at the time was 7 in the world. I don't know what she is now, but she is on the WTA Player Council. And we talked a little bit about how doubles is kind of underrepresented on that. And it makes sense that, you know, to potentially grow doubles, they need kind of their own sub-player council or sub-committee.
Well, yeah, but it's like, I agree about these committees and councils, but it's like, do something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Put some things together, put some money behind something, offer to give up 5% of your prize money to fund this stuff. Things that do it, not just a group of players that whine and tell what the tour should do for them. The players should figure out how to do these things. The players should just expect the tour to do it for them. The players should get involved in this. The players should take some ownership of this. I'm not saying they're building websites, but as far as things about access and about clinics and about reaching out, it's not just looking for someone to do something for them. It's making it happen. It's thinking, hey, we're on our own. We're part of the bottom line operating expenses of every tournament. How do we make that a viable part? How do we sing for our supper more?
So do you know a lot about the kind of financials of the tour?
I don't know a lot, not really. I mean, not entirely.
One thing you mentioned in your article was how the kind of tennis economy is in flux, just like the economy in general is. And it got me thinking of like, if they continue to struggle for revenue over the next, I don't know, 6 or 12 months or something, like doubles might be one of the first things to go.
Well, you got to look at, that's right. So the doubles people, they should be thinking about that. So they should be preemptively, proactively putting themselves out there, right? Demonstrating their value and demonstrating their greatness and doing things and not just doing something more than just playing great tennis and making money for it, but demonstrating their value. Look, we all know there's going to be in the next couple of years some form of reckoning around scheduling, around travel, around tournaments. I mean, a lot of things with the pandemic have been influenced by this. I mean, look, the Australian Open is now going to be played in February. So how does that impact the other tournaments that were going to be happening then? Do they continue? Do they move? Do others move? Do they can't? I mean, just a lot of things that need to take effect in the tennis economy. So again, if I'm a doubles person, I think I have a great opportunity to not just sit and just kind of wait, but maybe to reach out, to connect.
Right. Yeah, go make something happen.
Yeah.
So we've got our five, or your five ideas for growing the game of doubles. I want to take a step back and let's talk a little bit about the evolution of the game. So when we talked last week, you asked me how often I serve in volley, and I told you probably 30 to 50% of the time, which I feel like is high.
How old are you?
31.
Yeah, keep going. Tell me more what we talked about.
So I feel like that's kind of high for most players my age. But then you told me you don't think you've ever served and stayed back in your life.
In doubles? Yeah.
In doubles.
I'm twice your age. I'm 6 years old. I learned to serve in volley and play tennis in Southern California on fairly fast hard courts. A lot of one-handed backhands. I was serving too. I get it. But I was taught that you serve in volley and doubles and on your first and second serve. And I have never, ever walked up to the line and said, you know what? I think I'm going to serve and stay back. I've been trapped. Occasionally, there's been a return that's so good that I'm suddenly like, whoa, I'm back here. What am I doing? But if I'm not in two shots later, yeah, that hasn't happened either. I've never, like, you got your big Western forehand. You stand back, then you slug. I was also taught, I learned this more lately, but I get it. Doubles is playing for your partner. So to me, when I play with a partner who's serving and staying back, I'm thinking, now, how are you helping us work as a team? What are you doing to help us form the classic wall that a team, but doubles has evolved. And I know the quality of ground strokes is much better than it once was. And the strings and the technology, particularly at the pro level, much greater ability to dip the ball. And I don't think that's as true at the recreational level. And I'll say that. And I mean by that 5-5 on down.
Yeah.
I just don't think that's as true. However, the way people have learned the game is much more baseline focused over the last 30, even 40 years.
Right.
Much more.
Yeah, that makes tons of sense. Yeah, when I was doing clinics and lessons growing up, so this would be like late 90s, early 2000s, I'd be in a clinic with maybe 8 other students or something like that. And we'd go twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I would probably go a month or two straight and not miss a clinic and probably not hit one volley.
Can I contact the instructor? Can I file a lawsuit on your behalf?
No, he was a good guy. He's my high school tennis coach too.
Why?
It was just how they taught. It was just all singles and all ground strokes.
They may not have learned how to volley. I mean, look, and to me, I'm not saying the volley is everything. I'm just saying the game is the widest. You know, there are 26 letters that define the tennis alphabet. And yet a lot of people like that was good. For 2 months there, you were learning 17 of them. You know, it's like, and it's just to broaden the whole game. And this gets to the growth of the game factor. I meet a lot of players. They've learned a fairly narrow way and their brain, they're smarter than their game. The tennis, I know someone who mostly was a baseliner. And they were a lot smarter than that, but they had these Western grips and this 200 backhand, and they didn't have proper tools for learning how to volley. And so tennis was boring for them. Sure. It's like tennis, the alphabet would be boring if I only knew 17 letters.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about this the whole, and doubles, you know, the game used to be from like 1946 on for a long time. It was very much serve and volley into the 70s and even the 80s some, but particularly into the 70s. And doubles and singles were kind of part and parcel. Like the way I learned to play singles, which is very net rushing based, was connected to how you play doubles. So the skills were similar. You know, you get low returns and coming to net. But then when the game became more baseline, particularly people, Borg really started it. And Bjorn Borg, he stopped playing doubles. And the high stakes, there was enough money. So a lot more singles players stopped playing doubles. So doubles kind of fell apart at the pro level. I mean, there was a time all the top 20 players were playing doubles, but that changed. And that's okay. I understand why a player who's playing 5-set matches at Wimbledon or the US Open or Roland Garros or Australia, they don't want to be playing a 5-set singles match that ends at 8 at night and then have to play a doubles match and then risk being worn out the next day. And there's enough money for them to afford not to have to play doubles.
Okay. So that's the reason. So before Borg, all the top 20 players play, and then Borg's kind of stopped.
Borg started Borg doubles. And then Connors. Connors played a good amount of doubles. Connors and Borg actually played doubles once together at the Australian Open. But Borg, I think, was really the start of the thing. Like, don't need doubles. I don't need doubles. Doubles is not – let's just focus on the singles. And his singles game was very physical and fitness-based and groundstroke-based, a little more of what I'd call an east-west than a north-south mover.
Sure.
So he kind of really started it. And other players, including Connors and Guillermo Vilas, they picked up from it. And then that continued into the 80s with Lendl and the whole Sampras-Agassi generation. And it, granted, I understood it. I understand it at the pro level. I don't necessarily have a problem with it at the pro level.
Okay, and it seemed like it was just a money thing. So they realized
the economics. There were enough rewards in singles. They didn't need the incremental money from doubles. They wanted to focus and perform properly in singles. I get it.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Yeah, I talked with I used to work with Coach Edgar Giffenig. He worked with the Bryan brothers when they were juniors, and he sat down and interviewed them a few years back, and they talked about this transition from baseline to, or from serve and volley players. And then they were talking about a lot of players are serving and staying back. And they mentioned that string technology.
Right.
They said that, you know, a lot of times we're even having to serve and stay back because these returners, especially if you get a singles player out there who's top 20 or something, these returns are coming so hard and so heavy at our feet. You know, it doesn't make sense for us to serve and volley against these because it's just too difficult, especially.
I get it at the pro level. I get it on the pro level. I think it's tragic exactly. At the recreational level. I think it's tragic. I think it's made it blunts improvement and the overall growth of the game. I think at the recreational level, to see a great many people playing doubles and serving and staying back and not really working together as teams and winning matches, I get it, but it's like, what's really going on here? I mean, there was a junior I played with when he was about 12, and he was getting good enough. He's beating the 4 or 5 hacks like myself, and we played doubles with him a little bit, and he would serve and stay back and whale forehands with this another person, a pretty good 5-0 woman, and he'd whale forehands back and forth with her just to enjoy it. And I said to the dad after this, you know, when he's 12, he should be serving and volleying against us. This is the time to build that skill. And the father said, well, this is how kids today play. I go, you know, I won the spelling bee and I was number 3 in fractions. But when I started doing grammar and algebra, my mommy didn't threaten to, and struggling a little bit, my mommy didn't threaten to fire my teacher. In other words, the developmental aspect of the game, the broad set of skills that's going to help you become a better player in singles and doubles and college and beyond, that's the time for it. He's 12 years old. Well, he's getting no learning standing and wailing. On the other hand, if he serves in volleys against us, now he's developing. Right. Now he's developing. I know someone who has a son who's very good, and the son is a teenager who's gotten pretty good, and the father can hit with his son, but he's not as good as the son. I said, good, have him play you serving and volleying. Let's see if he can beat. Can he beat you serving and volleying? Can he beat you with one serve serving and volleying? It's a skill build. That's all it is. It's like a basketballer who learns to shoot with the other hand.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just another, even if you're not going to serve and volley every time when you play, like I don't, but it's just another tool in your toolkit. Like why would you not take an extra tool to help you potentially win? Because against some teams, you're going to need it.
I'll tell you something, my latest thinking on why are the great players that much greater? What is Nadal? You know, there's always in every era, there's 2 or 3 of the super geniuses. It's Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer now. It was Borg, Connors, and McEnroe. It was Lendl. It was Becker and Edberg. It was Sampras. You know, there's always 2 or 3, bless you. There's always 2 or 3 guys who are like, and everyone wonders, what about them? How come they're able to do something? And my latest thinking is this. They're able to, the match is a series of plays and patterns. You and I are playing a singles match. And this will have implications for doubles. And we're engaged in certain ways that we play a lot. You know, you like to do the Western forehand and you hit the inside out and I want to come to net. And then what happens at a key stage in the match, the better player will come up with something surprising. Nadal is playing Diego Schwartzman. He's up 2 sets to love, but it's 5-all in the third. Nadal doesn't want to go to a fourth set, does he? Of course not. So what does he do on a big point? He serves in volleys. Whoa, where'd that come from? Not only has he won that point, he's also kind of shattered Schwartzman's mind, like, whoa, what's going to happen now? Now what next might he do? He hasn't just won 1 point. He's kind of won 10 points. And he goes on to win the tiebreaker 7-0 because I think you kind of planted a whole other element of doubt into the match. And so the implication for doubles is for people to play doubles and use doubles as skill building. You and I could cite a number of top pro players, very good pro players, who would have become even better if they played doubles some and played doubles, maybe serving volley, and built that skill. And they could bring that to their singles.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you hear people talk about it on TV. I mean, on the Tennis Channel, they'll say, you know, they'll ask Paul Anacone or somebody, you know, what does he need for his singles game? And it's a lot of the time, it's like he needs to learn to approach the net more and feel more comfortable with that first volley.
Sure. Well, why wouldn't Simona Halep play some doubles? Play some doubles, serve and volley.
Sure.
What's the harm in that? Particularly during these tournaments where you're playing, where you're not playing 3 out of 5, men, you know, when women don't play 3 out of 5, why not?
Yeah,
absolutely. Play some doubles. It's practice time. It's time on the court. That's why I really like Katie McNally. She plays singles. She plays doubles. She's a really good doubles player. She and Coco Gauff are a fine team. Katie understands doubles really well. Her mother, Lynn Neighbors, was a great player, played at Northwestern. Her traveling coach, Kevin O'Neill, understands all that. So that's part of the skill building part.
Yeah. Yeah. She is, for listeners who want to watch a doubles player and learn a lot from her, Katie McNally is really good. I watched her a bunch this summer in World Team Tennis and then at the US Open a little bit. And she is a very, very smart doubles player. So next, I had some notes from our conversation last week. Experience playing with the pros, match with McEnroe. Does that ring a bell?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about. Yes, it does. So what do you want to know?
Tell us the story.
Oh,
I've
been very lucky in my life. I had a number of times. I've had a number of experiences in my life and career being on the court with world-class players. And one of them, once I got to play in a pro-am with John McEnroe. And how it worked, it was John McEnroe and about four of us as his team versus the other teams. And we would like rotate in for a few points at a time. But at one point, we reached a stage where if we won this sequence, we'd win the title. You know, it's these round robins, these game accumulations. And McEnroe was at the net and I was serving to Jimmy Connors. So that was really fun. Huh. And I asked McEnroe what to do. I'm serving in the deuce court. He goes, serve to his forehand and get up to the net. And I did, I got the serve to Connors' forehand, but you know, these are pretty good players. And he hits this inside out forehand and I'm late for the volley and I hit the volley long. And then we lost the point, but then the next point I served to someone who is considerably weaker than me and served a good enough serve. So I got to win the pro-am with John McEnroe, which proved the long-standing line that the best doubles team in the world is McEnroe and anybody.
That is so cool. Yeah, in Memphis, at the tournament, it's not there anymore, but the tournament, I ball boyed for it growing up, and they had this kids' day where they'd grab a kid from the crowd and go play with the Bryan brothers or whoever, and my cousin got picked out and got to go play doubles with the Bryan brothers.
Great.
Yeah, I remember how fun that was. That's really good story. Next, I had a note on asking you about playing doubles as a lefty. Are you left-handed?
I am left-handed, yes.
Okay.
Right. So I think it's nice to be left-handed in doubles because it's always good. Lefty-righty teams, a great many of the best teams in tennis are that way. You're bringing different looks. You don't have to serve in the sun. You got different serves. You know, a lot of things go on. One of the things that's interesting is that when For many years, the classic formation was the lefty always played the ad court, because the premise was that lefties had these cross court forehands, and the one-handed backhand was this kind of this inside out chip shot that wasn't that good. So you wanted lefties forehands on the corners, because the game was thought to be played by angles. But that's changed. And then when I was growing up playing doubles, because I'd been told that lefties had worse backhands than forehands, and Rod Laver was still near the end of his career, but he's still playing. He had this good topspin backhand. Between him and going to Tony Traber tennis camp, Tony had taught this topspin backhand. I learned a topspin backhand, so my backhand became better than my forehand. And I liked that cross-court backhand in the deuce court. So I started playing the deuce court. And then I saw that some other pros did, but they do it because, like the Bryan brothers, put Bob in the deuce court. And I think what they found, I think, in doubles in more recent years is doubles is really not so much about angles. It's more about dealing with the middle and having, let's say, a big forehand that can do things like Bob's return in the deuce court, Mike's forehand in the deuce court. And the Bryans, I think one of their mottos was, let's never lose a point down the middle. So you got both forehand volleys and all that. So that kind of changed. But being a left-hander, I enjoy being a left-hander in doubles, because also in the ad court, you can serve wide. You know, you can hit the wide serve, which can pay a lot of dividends. Sometimes, though, I'll tell you a funny story. I was playing a tournament match with a friend once, and we'd reached the stage in the third set tiebreak. It was like we were serving at 5-4 in the third set tiebreak to 7. So if we win this point, it's going to be match point. And I'm serving the ad court, and my partner says, why don't you surprise him and go down the tee? And if earlier in this show, I was talking about doubt and doing something different, but this is a different stage. So 5-4, third set tiebreak. I said, surprise him. Are you kidding? At this point, I'll tell him where I'm going to serve. I was almost tempted to say, hey, guess where it's going? You know, it's like a baseball pitcher. It's like, certain
pitches. Really good in his
head. Two counts. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here we go. So of course I serve wide in the ad court. So of course I serve wide. Yeah. And more importantly, we won the point, but I didn't hit an ace. I'm not Pete Sampras, and I'm not John McEnroe. But more importantly, I forget if he missed it. He may not have missed the turn, but more importantly, I got a playable volley. You know, that's what we play for in tennis, is how to hit one shot to get us the shot we want. You know, constant set of building blocks, one to the next.
Yeah, watching the ATP finals, I meant to sit down and pull out a spreadsheet and look this up, but I felt like, I know there were at least 3 of the 8 teams that were lefty-righty combo. I feel like it might have been 4 or 5.
It's funny, the fact that we don't know shows you we should know that. Maybe they should put on, maybe when they put their names, they should put like a little parenthesis, the L and R.
I know. I meant to look it up, and I didn't sit down and do it. But it does seem like it's a huge advantage. And I, with my readers and listeners, I do actually always recommend forehands in the middle to control that kind of middle area. But that's interesting to hear you say it used to be the opposite advice.
Well, classically, it was the lefty in the ad court, because the lefty, it wasn't thought that the lefty could hit a good enough backhand return from the deuce court against the wide serve, because lefties in the one-handed era used to, before Laver, this is around 50s, 60s, before Laver, lefties, there weren't any lefties with tops and backhands. So the lefty would chip, the lefty would kind of leak it inside out. So the lefty in the deuce court couldn't hit a quality enough return to get across, because you don't want to really slice
net player
cross court. That's right. You'd be meat. You'd be lunch meat for the poach.
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense. So another thing I wanted to ask about is a Bryan brothers drill that we talked about.
Last time. You've seen, have you seen it? It's called the RDC. They start on the Romanian Davis Cup. I think their dad or maybe them saw the Romanian Davis Cup team do it. You start with both players kind of at the tee, and it's a cooperative drill. You go back and forth, and then I would see, Bob moves to his right, and Mike, they each move to their right, and they continue to volley diagonally. Go diagonal, and to the end, and you come back. I mean, they could do it for hours because they're the Bryan brothers, but it's a great drill to do with a friend. It's a cooperative drill. Not every drill is cooperative, but this is meant to be cooperative.
Right.
And it has to do with balance and posture, and how do we maintain our position. We're not trying to crack the ball. We're not trying to hit a winner. You're not trying to compromise me. I'm not trying to compromise you. So you're just doing this drill back and forth. You can see it's on YouTube. I'm pretty sure they've shown it on YouTube.
Okay. What was it?
RDC, Romanian Davis Cup. The Romanian Davis Cup team of Ilie Năstase and Ion Tiriac many years ago. I think they were doing it. And I think Wayne Brown may have seen it and he nicknamed it that. So it's not, the drill has nothing to do with the name. So the name has nothing to do with the drill.
RDC, got it. So I send out my doubles newsletter every Thursday. And yesterday I sent out three drills. And one of them, I think, was that drill. And I couldn't remember where I got it from. But I guess I got it from you last week. I called it Volley Around the World is what I called it.
That's good, too. That's fine. That's actually, yours is a little more accurate. Volley Around the World, yeah.
So do they stay on the service line or do they kind of move?
Yes, you're both on the service line. You're both
okay.
You stay on the service line. The point is to maintain balance and posture, and consistency and control. It's not called the let me close the net and finish it off drill. I mean, it's amazing how people practice their volleys and they get too close to the net, and they're not really doing anything, and then they think they should hit a winner. It's fine. It's like I saw someone doing that when we were volleying once. I said that's funny. When we're doing ground stroke drills, when we're doing ground stroke hitting, I don't suddenly three shots into the ground stroke hit a winner, do I? If you and I are cooperatively hitting ground strokes, we're doing ground strokes, going cross, 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 oh, maybe hit one down the line, but we're just cooperative. It's like we're playing catch.
Yeah.
But yeah, people, absolutely, when it comes to volleys, they still think, okay, here's my chance to close. It's like, well, no, you don't do that. I mean, it's called a drill. It's called cooperative.
Yeah, it's good to practice those angles too.
That's right, because then you're seeing the quarter, and then you also, like when I've done that drill, I see which volleys I control better than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which volley I can control from which position better. Oh, which volley requires more? Oh wow, look at me! I'm having to do these little manipulations with my racket. That's not good. As opposed to this drill, I have my whole body involved here. This is good. Now I have my body.
Yeah, I talked with Eric Buderak.
A lefty.
He was on the show, and that was one of his pieces of advice for rec players. He said that a lot of when he sees rec players practice their volleys, it's always the same way, with one person back, one person at the net, and they're just volleying back to the baseline instead of, you know, some. And then in the match, you're having trouble with these short angle volleys, but you never practice them.
Right.
This cooperative drill, the RDC drill, will help people do that, you know, volleying cross court from the deuce or ad court.
Sure. Lots of drills.
So talk a little bit about your show with Amy and Gil called Three.
Oh, this is called Three, a show about Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. It's terrific. Amy Lundy and Gil Gross and I talk, and we talk about, we focus on these great players on different things, whether it's things that are going on in the news with them, whether it's matches or statements or events or scheduling or practice. And we use that as a launching pad. And then we get into topics that relate to them. It's terrific. We did on one show, for example, we ended up talking about Guillermo Vilas, the great left-handed Argentine from the 70s, who is very much an ancestor of Nadal stylistically. If you watch Vilas play, you'll see the physicality of his forehand and his left-handed game. And then we talk about different things, about things you can learn from players. We talk about them in the news. I mean, obviously when they're playing, there's lots in the news to talk about them. We talked about their matches in London recently. Next, soon enough, we'll have a lot more of Roger. So that'll be fun too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So for anybody who's a fan of the big three, or any one of the big three, definitely check that out. I'll link to it in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
So people can find it.
Yeah, it's terrific. I really enjoy it. Amy and Gil are great. We each bring different perspectives to it. Gil is a Syracuse, and he's going to become a broadcaster. Amy's a longstanding journalist and broadcaster and journalist herself. I have my background. So it's a nice mix of things we bring.
Awesome.
All three of us play, so that's fun too.
So next I wanted to get into the rapid fire questions. Do you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, it's fine. You just go. Just go ahead.
All right. So several questions here. You can answer them in short or long form, up to you. What is your favorite tennis book?
One of my favorite tennis books, it's a book called The Terrible Splendor, about a tremendous tennis match played by Don Budge and Gottfried von Kramm, a 1937 Davis Cup match, authored by the writer Marshall John Fisher. It's a great book about this Davis Cup match, each of their biographies, each of their playing styles. There's a Third Reich Nazi angle to it also. So there's just a lot of tension to the match, and the story and the pacing is just marvelous.
Awesome. What is your favorite tournament to go to?
From a sheer process standpoint, I've always enjoyed going to Indian Wells. I live in California. I've been going to this tournament for 40 years. It's got a really nice energy and atmosphere, kind of like the spring training atmosphere of baseball. Players are accessible. The weather is beautiful, the desert in March. Being from California, I often see a lot of people I know there. So it's really fun. It's got a great festival-like atmosphere to it. I like going to all the majors also, but I would say if you just said to me one, I think that's one I really enjoy.
Perfect. What is your favorite piece that you've written?
Oh, I don't know. That's your kind. I don't know. What do you think it is?
I don't know. I don't know every piece you've written.
All right.
I liked your doubles piece.
You like my doubles piece? You have a show about doubles. I don't know. That's like asking someone to which one of their children they like most. I enjoy.
Just what comes to mind.
I did a piece last year on advertising in tennis for Racquet magazine that was mentioned in the anthology Best American Sports Writing as a notable piece. So that was good. I did a piece about that was a long piece that I really enjoyed that explored aspects of American culture. I did a shorter piece on the memorial service for the great Pancho Segura, who was a great player and coach, and also Jimmy Connors' coach too. And I wrote about that. That's what I felt proud about. But I don't know. Those are two that come to mind that I got a lot of satisfaction of.
Okay, perfect. What is the, and I'm not sure how you'll measure this, but what is the most popular piece you've ever written?
I can't even begin to tell. I don't know. Maybe can I tell you what the most unpopular piece is? No, I have no idea. I have no idea. You mean the one, they don't track pieces like, they don't track pieces like
traffic to a webpage like I'm used to.
Well, look, I've written for a great many things other than websites. So, and I wouldn't use clicks as a sign of popularity. I would just say that was clicks. I did a piece. Here's a silly piece I did a few years ago. Do you remember when Federer, Tommy Haas, and Dimitrov did this one-handed backhand boys music video? They did a song to the Chicago song. So hard for me to say I'm sorry, and they sang it. They did a video about it. So I wrote a piece a few weeks later that decoded the meaning of the song. That was almost like a satire of rock music analysis about what were they really saying in the song. And that got a lot of clicks, but that was just a fun, silly story.
That's good though. I'll find that and link to it as well.
Okay.
So the last question, what is a tennis story that you've never told anyone?
That exists, that I'd like to tell?
Sure.
That I'd like to tell, that it's something in tennis that I'd like to write about more?
Yeah, that works. Yeah, a lot of people have, I ask this to every guest, what's a tennis story you've never told anyone? And a lot of people say, oh, I don't have one. So then I'll just ask, what's your favorite tennis story? So Nick Monroe, for example, talked about on the way to a tournament in Africa, he was actually shot at in his cab on the way to the tournament. So he tells that story, which is...
Oh, you know, I'll tell you a story that a story that comes to mind that I like to tell in depth that I touched on earlier this year when you mentioned Nick Monroe's experience. There was a tournament in Lagos, Nigeria that was once postponed because of a coup. It was a government coup in the middle of the tournament. And I touched on it a little briefly earlier this year with a couple of players who were involved in it in a story about, when COVID began about tennis interrupted. So I mentioned that. But that's a story I'd like to do in more depth. I'd like to explore that in more depth about the coup and how that happened. And there are players, for example, there's a player named Ampon. His last name is Ampon. He was from the Philippines, and he was somewhere around 5 feet tall And I'm saying he was great, but he was a little limited because of, but he was this great player. And one of his rivals said he played like Roger Federer, just wasn't quite as good. And so I enjoy finding players who were great, but they weren't quite, they didn't win Wimbledon, they're not quite as known, and digging out aspects of their stories. I mean, I've been talking with a friend, there was a player, your tennis trophy, all your tennis trophies with the guy in the trophy position, that was a man named Les Stofan, who was a great player from the 30s, who went on to become a tennis instructor.
That would be a good article.
He was a great doubles player, by the way. He and George Lott were a very good team. And I would like to, let's say, learn more about Les Stofan. I enjoy learning about these tennis subcultures and these people and these places.
That's really cool. Yeah, that would be, I thought I might have a trophy right here, but I don't. That would be a really cool article. Where does the guy on the top of your tennis trophy come from?
Yeah, and he ended up teaching. He was from Los Angeles originally, and he ended up teaching in San Diego at the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club.
That's cool. Really good story. All right. Well, thanks, Joel, for doing this.
Sure.
Once the tours reach out to me and want to hire us as consultants to fix doubles, I'll let you know.
Let's see. I think that's great. Let's see what they think. Why don't you send this link, send our show to some of them. I think we got some good ideas. You and I make a good team. Which court do you receive in when you
ad
play
court.
Doubles? The ad court?
Ad court.
That's good. So I'll be the lefty in the deuce court. We'll never –
Absolutely.
You know, I do like to sometimes lob the backhand return. So I hit the lob. They run back, and you just slide, and then the overhead's going to come right back to you in the middle.
Oh, that's
so you
easy.
Nail the overhead.
Yeah, that's why I have my forehand volley in the middle. Makes it easy.
Well, that's good. So good. I hope though, when we're playing together, you serve and volley some just a little bit more, just to join me.
It'll be 100% with you.
Oh my, 100%. Okay. Well, it's great. Great talking with you.
Let's do it. Good talking with you as well. Thanks a lot.
Hey.
If you're a doubles player, you'll love our weekly doubles newsletter. Every Thursday, we send you doubles tips and strategies to help you improve your game and become a smarter player. When you sign up, you'll get a free 10-page guide on how to play with more confidence and dominate at the net in doubles. You can go to thetennistribe.com to sign up now.